There's this book by Barbara Ehrenreich. And let me read you who Barbara Ehrenreich is. I used to go to the Socialist Party's annual meeting in New York, whenever it was in New York. And Barbara Ehrenreich was always the major speaker, just like Gloria, who's the feminist?
Steinem.
You know, Gloria.
Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, like Gloria Steinem was a figurehead for the feminist world. Barbara Ehrenreich was a feminist, but she was more of a lefty socialist and wrote books that sold well, so she became a spokesman like Gloria, what the heck?
Steinem.
Right. And here's how she's described. Born in 1941, is an American author and political activist who describes herself as a, quote, myth buster by trade and has been called a veteran muckraker by The New Yorker. During the 80s and 90s, she was a prominent figure in the Democratic Socialists of America. She is a widely read and award-winning columnist and essayist and author of 21 books. Ehrenreich is perhaps best known for her 2001 book, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America, a memoir of Ehrenreich's three-month experiment surviving on minimum wage as a waitress, hotel maid, house cleaner, nursing home aide, and Walmart clerk. It was described by Newsweek magazine as jarring and full of riveting grit, and by The New Yorker magazine as an expose putting human flesh on the bones of such abstractions as living wage and affordable housing. So that's a good socialist move. Go into the working class world, see what's actually happening, because she was a comfortable book writer and doing okay. Okay, so it says, what did she do?
It's too boring. Don't go on.
No, just have to show you who it is. After completing her doctorate, Ehrenreich did not pursue a career in science. So she did her PhD on cellular stuff. But she did not pursue a career in science. Instead, she worked first as an analyst with the Bureau of the Budget in New York City and with the Health Policy Advisory Center, and later as an assistant professor at the State University of New York at Old Westbury. In 1972, Ehrenreich began co-teaching a course on women and health with feminist journalist and academic Deirdre English. Through the rest of the 70s, Ehrenreich worked mostly in health-related research and health-related advocacy and activism, including co-writing with Deirdre English several feminist books and pamphlets on the history and politics of women's health. During this period, she began speaking frequently at conferences staged by women's health centers and women's groups and by universities and by the United States government. So she even has got the level of a status where the government would bring her in as a consultant. She also spoke regularly about socialist feminism and about feminism in general. Throughout her career, Ehrenreich has worked as a freelance writer, and she is arguably best known for her nonfiction reportage, book reviews, and social commentary. And then they list, many, many major periodicals, newspapers, and that. She's done reviews for many magazines. And she served as founder, advisor, or board member to a number of organizations, including the U.S. National Women's Health Network, the National Abortion Rights Action League, the National Mental Health Consumers Self-Help Clearinghouse, the Nationwide Women's Program of the American Friends Service Committee, those are the Quakers, the Brooklyn-based Association for Union Democracy, political activist Robert Bohm's Bohm Foundation, the Anti-Poverty Group Women's Committee of 100, the National Writers Union, the Progressive Magazine's Progressive Media Project, the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting Advisory Committee on Women in the Media, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, the Center for Popular Economics, and the Campaign for America's Future. Between 79 and 81, she served as an adjunct associate professor at New York University and also a visiting professor at the University of Missouri at Columbia and at Sangamon State University. Where is that? Sangamon. Springfield, Illinois. Okay. Let's see. She lectured at the University of California in Santa Barbara, was a writer in residence at the Ohio State University, Wayne Morse Chair at the University of Oregon, and a teaching fellow at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. She has been a fellow at the New York Institute for the Humanities, the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, the Institute for Policy Studies. They're the big enemy of LaRouche. LaRouche doesn't like them. They don't like LaRouche. And the New York-based Society of American Historians. In 2006, she founded United Professionals, an organization described as, quote, a nonprofit, nonpartisan membership organization for white-collar workers, regardless of profession or employment status. We reach out to all unemployed, underemployed, and anxiously employed workers, people who bought the American dream that education and credentials could lead to a secure middle-class life, but now found their lives disrupted by forces beyond their control. That was in 2006. As of 2013, she's an honorary co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America. She also serves on the NORML board, therefore legalization of marijuana. And she's on the trustees, the Institute for Policy Studies on the Board of Trustees, and the editorial board of the Nation magazine.
Oh, stop.
And she goes on and...
Stop it.
Wait a minute. Nobody heard that, Carolyn. You muted and you didn't know. She has served on the editorial boards of Social Policy, Ms., Mother Jones, 7 Days, Lears, The New Press, and Culture Front, and a contributing editor to Harper's. So, this is pretty incredible, accomplished person on the level of the Information Society. You know, she's an advisor. She teaches all over the place. She's like a freelance intellectual available for all kinds of things under the basic purpose of trying to help the working class. And so she's a socialist in that sense. Let's see, was there another thing she did? She's written many books, and one interesting book was, does it get reviewed? She, a few years ago, this is maybe 10 years ago, when people would, the economy's pretty weak, so people would take all kinds of courses on how to prepare themselves to survive. And they took a lot of New Age courses, what we call New Age courses, developing a positive attitude, creating your own reality, whatever that stuff is. So she found this was a trend in the working class, so she interviewed all these people. And I think we have a review here, a subset review, where... she says the working class is getting duped by this New Age kind of philosophy. Some people might think it's the kind of philosophy that Ion talks about. Tony Robbins' philosophy, right? You know, empower yourself, firewalk, make yourself strong, and don't take any shit, and get a job being a life coach and telling other people not to take shit, right? That's the scam, right? You learn how to teach everybody how to be powerful, and everybody ends up teaching each other, coaching each other, and being poor. So she's not inclined to like the kind of stuff that Carolyn, on some levels, is identified with. So a man named Lewis Lapham, who ran, edited Atlantic Monthly for years, he's a top old-style intellectual, writer, publisher. Did I say Atlantic Monthly? No, he was at Harper's Magazine. He was editor from 1976 until 81, and then returned 2 years later and went from 83 to 2006. That's 23 years. So in 1994, the MIT Press wanted to reissue McLuhan's Understanding Media. So they got Lewis Lapham to write the preface or foreword, and in it he confessed that he was one of those intellectuals in the 60s who thought McLuhan was a fool and ignored him. And he said when he saw the O.J. Simpson driving down, the L.A. highway in a white Bronco and people cheering him on, and the whole O.J. thing unfolded, and that was in 94, around the time that he was writing this foreword for the reissue of McLuhan's Understanding Media, he said, "I realized McLuhan was right." the media had taken over, and we had a whole different kind of mindset in Americans from what a book guy, a Gutenberg guy in the 60s, didn't realize what was happening to the visual space of literacy and didn't catch up to it till the 90s. So he is an eminence grise in the intellectual world, and he would be on top of Barbara Ehrenreich's work because she's successful like him in the what are they called, the wonk class. They say Hillary Clinton's part of the wonk world of people having think tanks and advising think tanks and writing reports for them. Lewis Lapham is maybe not that perfectly, but he is a famous guy in the media. And he's running the media of Harper's Magazine, which is a trendsetter for ideas. So probably Barbara Ehrenreich is her friend. Is his friend. So he's going to read her latest book. So I will now start to play the interview he does with her. And we're going to stop and start it so that we and Carolyn can comment on it because it's very relevant to Carolyn. All right.
Can I give my conclusion?
No. Well, we let them go through the process of learning. What's your conclusion about where we're going to go with this?
Yeah.
No. This way. Let's
go through it. Oh, please. I'm going to say my conclusion. Barbara Ehrenreich is an ill-informed thought leader mixing up allopathic medicine and alternative medicine in an impossible mosh pit of inaccuracy.
Okay. All right, so let's find out if Carolyn's right. Let's hear the interview.
Prove me wrong.
Yeah, let's see if Lewis, who's very impressed with Barbara's book.
No, oh, God.
What?
Nothing.
This is hard for Carolyn. The book is called... And so Barbara Ehrenreich, she knows the trends, and she finds out what's happening to her generation and youngers, and then goes and does a book on the trend.
Mm-hmm.
So this book
is called Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer.
That's the whole title. Okay, could you read that title again? It's called Natural Causes.
An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying, and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer.
So we know that this is a direct attack on Ion, right?
Mm-hmm. And
and Carolyn. And so let's see how good they make their case. So we have it right here in our soundboard.
Yeah, it's only a half-hour interview. I'm sure we can drag it on for about 4 or 5 hours, though.
Right. And there is there's a review of it on Amazon, Carol?
Yeah.
And this guy is a fan of Barbara Ehrenreich. And
the title of what he writes in the review is The Worst Read of the Year So Far.
And he begins his review. Wow, what a disappointment. Perhaps my expectations were too high. And he says, I acknowledge that I expected a lot from the
writer of Nickel.
No. I have the clear voice here. I'm going to say it. I acknowledge that I expected a lot from the writer of Nickel and Dime. That was the one where she hung out with the working class. The book that changed my tipping habits in particular and my view of the life of the low-level worker in general. And the subject matter of Natural Causes was perfectly in sync with my circumstances. Dealing with advancing age and a cancer diagnosis, that's his present circumstances. My situation has been fermenting since early 2017, and by now I've come to the conclusion that my generation, the boomers, are not going to put up with the medical/pharmaceutical/health insurance industry's standard operating procedures. Instead, we were going to take charge of our lives, our health care, and the manner of our death. So when he read a review of this book by Ehrenreich, he ordered it. right away and was excitedly thinking it was about what he was into. Turns out, not at all. That's why he says it's the worst read of the year. Wow, what a disappointment, because he was a real fan of her. So that's there's more from that, his detailed review, which is pretty interesting, but we can do that later. So now we hear Lewis Lapham, who is quite fond of Barbara Ehrenreich as an intellectual. So they say this.
This is Lewis Lapham for Lapham's Quarterly, and this is The World in Time. Lead support for this podcast has been provided by Elizabeth Lizette Prince. Additional support was provided by James J. Jimmy Coleman, Jr. Speaking today with the essayist Barbara Ehrenreich about her new book, Natural Causes. The book, Barbara, strikes me as your report and reflections on our American fear of death. And you present your arguments and your observations and lessons of your own experience, and maybe you can begin by telling us how you come by the subject of this book.
The first thing was a close observation of people in my sort of demographic, people who were educated middle-class people who were middle-aged or older. And I began to feel that there was something strange going on with them some years ago, when I noticed more and more of my friends, very smart people, often politically active and so on, getting further and further into the subject of their own bodies and their own possibilities of lengthening their lives through controlling what they eat or how much they exercise or obeying the medical rules about preventive medicine that is supposed to save you and add years to your life. And I did not share this obsession, I will admit. It seems to me I'll eat things I like, and I exercise because I like it. And as for the preventive medical care, well, in the last 10 or 15 years, I began to give up on that, just began, stopped doing it. And I'm talking about all the tests and screenings and doctor's visits you're expected to submit to once you get, say, over 50 or even over 40. And I noticed that they were piling them on, things I had never heard of, like bone density scans. And it's in my nature to question everything. So in each case, with each new test or screening they wanted me to go through, I would do some research and try to find out if this indeed did any good. And what I mean by that is not something subjective on my part, but looking into what the more statistically and mathematically oriented medical people were saying about the particular test. If they say that something is actually good for the public health, you'd have to show that in large numbers of people where the test is done, people live longer than people who do not get, you know, another large group of people who don't get that test done. And we're beginning to have that data more and more for more kinds of tests. So at first I was more compliant. I went through the bone density scan because my primary care physician was begging me to. And it turned out I have a problem. I suffer from osteopenia, which means that the bones are thinning and are more fragile than they used to be. Now, actually, this is true for most women who are past menopause. So I don't consider that a disease. I consider that just a part of aging.
Go back. When you say a disease, I mean, when did we start thinking about death as a disease?
Well, osteopenia as a disease. That was actually something more or less invented by Merck, the pharmaceutical company, which developed what they said would be a cure for low bone density. Unfortunately, that you look into that cure a little more, look at their drugs, and it has a lot of bad effects, like increasing the possibility of bone fractures in many people. So that's kind of, I thought, well, what is this? Why did I bother doing this test? Only to find out I have something that women my age almost always have, and that there is no respectable cure for. So from that, it went one thing after another. I just began to suspect them all.
What you call a wellness industry is an enormous business in this country. I mean, many billions of dollars. I mean, this has been happening over the last, 20 or 30 years, right? I mean, we spend something like $3 trillion a year on healthcare of various forms, right?
Yes, we do. And I would say that spending is skewed in a questionable way toward those people who have insurance, which means once you're 65, pretty much all of us, we've Medicare. And then we become a big, source of profits. So that's, yeah. But wellness isn't just about healthcare. Healthcare is the old-fashioned kind of thing of going to a doctor's office and, having procedures performed on you and so on. Wellness is something else. Wellness is for the rich. Wellness is for the rich and means spending time well at luxury wellness spas around the world where you may chant and meditate and have hot stones placed on different parts of your body. I don't ask me to explain what these things do. And wellness is Gwyneth Paltrow with her business called Goop, which sells extremely expensive things to apply to your skin or diets to follow and so on.
We don't have any evidence that this stuff works, do we?
Oh, no. But it's about loving yourself. You know, the more things you can do that show how much you love yourself, the better. And if they're expensive, well, that just shows how much more you love yourself. You can really spend full time doing these various modalities of wellness.
But it goes along with the, what Christopher Lash called in the 80s the culture of narcissism, right? I mean, this is, we live in a very narcissistic society, do we not?
Yes, especially among the wealthy. I mean, narcissism is much more a disease of the wealthy, if it's a disease at all. But, Christopher Lash in the 70s said that a whole generation, I guess my generation, was retreating from politics because we had failed in the 60s to change things fundamentally. So now we were just turning inward to our own selves, our own bodies, and our minds, or better yet, our own mind bodies, as we now call them.
I think you say somewhere that the feeling that we had no control in a political arena, that we couldn't, that our democracy wasn't working, but maybe we could have control of our own bodies.
Yep, and it's not just our democracy or politics, it's also our jobs. You know, there is no great security for middle-level managerial people. Everything has changed. So I understand this myself. I know I can't do anything, that I can think of anyway, about Donald Trump and what he's about to do next. But when I go to the gym, I can work on my quadriceps, and I have some control there. I know this feeling. And yeah, you just shrink your concerns to the perimeter of your own physical self, and yeah, you can get somewhere a little bit.
That's what you call in a chapter called crushing the body, right?
Yes. Yes, that's not my term. It's not enough to have a good workout. You have to crush your body. And at my gym, they've added a new course called Shredding Your Body. This is really a violently aggressive form of control directed at your body.
To what end? I mean, why?
Longevity.
But we have no evidence that produces longevity, do we?
There is some evidence that exercise helps, that it seems to extend longevity. But what kind of exercise exactly, how much? And then some of the other things people are doing, like this fanatical concern with what you put in your mouth, you know, about what you eat. Most of that is not evidence-based in any way. In the 90s, the big thing was not to eat fat.
Yeah.
Remember when Shane Brody in the New York Times was telling us that fat was poison and we should just eat carbs? Well, that seems to have resulted in the obesity epidemic, because people switched from their normal diets to eating lots of fat-free chocolate chip cookies.
Tell us about the chapter called Cellular Treason, the discovery that the body maybe has ideas of its own and is not a subject of our discipline.
Yeah, well, it just underlines how little control we have. The idea has been that, yeah, if you think the right thoughts and eat the right foods and so on, you can totally control what goes on in your physical body. But then we look at certain kinds of ailments, and what they show is a complete lack of control, or our lack of control so far. I would hope we would get further, but like the body is made up of cells. Cells are the smallest living unit of the body. The old picture of cells was that they were like citizens of a communist dictatorship. They were happily doing their job for the collective. They cared nothing for themselves. They were completely obedient. Well, that's not what it really looks like. Cancer, for example, is a rebellion by a cell, beginning with one cell usually, that decides, Anna, I don't want to keep doing my job here. I want to rampage throughout the body and reproduce and set up new colonies of my own clones. And then you've got cancer. Autoimmune diseases are diseases in which immune cells, which we would think are our defenders, decide they're going to attack some organ of the body or some other part of the body. And they do it. You know, they have no concern for the whole organism. So you get, if more you look into it, the less you see the body as a complete, harmonious whole. And the more you see it as a battleground.
You started your life, if I remember, as a PhD graduate in cell biology. So you began to understand cells, particularly one that you referred to as the macrophage. I want you to talk about the macrophage, because this discovery that cells have agency, if not necessarily consciousness, came to you as a big surprise.
Oh, it really did. Shocking surprise. It was in about 2009, and I read in Scientific American about the then still recent discovery that macrophages assist tumors in their, you know, war against the rest of the body. It has been known for a long time that macrophages gather around tumors. Macrophages are the immune cells that are at the front lines, say, when microbes invade your bloodstream. They're very good fighters. Their name macrophage means big eaters in Greek. They kill by engulfing and eating their quarry. So when I studied macrophages, we didn't know anything bad about them. I thought they were heroes in the battle against microbes. So it was a shock to see that they are in fact enabling the spread of cancer around the body. For me, that just seemed to change everything I had assumed about biology.
So, that is cellular treason. I mean, they have agency, but not consciousness. Explain that, because I think people might get confused.
Yeah, it is confusing, and it's all new. I would say this is, you know, talking about very recent, last, say, decade or so research. Macrophages are interesting because they are very mobile cells. They don't just move around because the blood carries them around. They can decide, they can kind of go places. And they can attack, you know, cells of your body that they deem to be unhealthy, or they can attack any cell. And why do they do that when it in the end will mean death for them too, if the whole body dies? Well, what cell biologists are saying now is that they make decisions. That doesn't mean that they're conscious of, obviously. They don't have any nervous system or anything. It's one cell. But they have choices to make, like whether to attack another cell and where to move to next. And they make those choices somehow on the basis of incoming chemical signals. And God knows what. But that is to say they have agency. They can do things. They can cause changes in their environment.
I mean, we wouldn't be far wrong in making an analogy between a macrophage and Donald Trump.
Well, yeah, there's something there. The analogy that's usually made, you know, for the immune system in general, is it's like a garrison of soldiers that you have in your town to protect the town, right? But that garrison can also, you know, get drunk and decide to rape and pillage in the town. So when you have killer cells like macrophages, there's a risk in that.
What does the notion of cells acting on their own do to our idea of the self? You have a chapter called The Invention of the Self. Talk about that, Barbara, and talk about that in terms of narcissism and who is in charge of our body and where or what is the self?
Well,
okay, that goes into another theme. We've done about half of it, 15 minutes. A lot of stuff there, Carol. So you might want to get your notes. So they said that this wellness obsession, this narcissism started, Lewis Laffin said, about 30 years ago. That's probably right. I remember in the 30s, I mean in the 80s, people, they started doing the what do you call that, jogging in the club? Bionics, or Jane Fonda led it?
Aerobics?
That kind of stuff. So people were doing a lot of in the clubs, all ages, but the boomers were really getting into it. Then I heard about the Canyon Ranch, And those kind of retreats where they did acupuncture and herbs and saunas and things, that became a trend in the 80s. And you always knew people involved with that and were sort of semi-enthusiastic about that. I don't think you were enthusiastic about aerobics.
Mm.
Okay, you got to stop eating, Carol. Let's get into it.
I did for a while. I weightlifted so much that I increased my neck size so I couldn't do up my blouses at my neck. We all got into it.
Are you on mute?
Except Bob didn't. I don't think so.
Yeah, I played ball hockey.
Right. But anyway, yeah, you're right. I mean, there was a surge of that. And what... So she's just identifying, she's observing what happened.
Okay, so it started in the 80s, jogging, a lot of jogging, though people did that in the 70s. But the narcissistic trend, some people called it, started happening in the 80s. And so the baby boomers were 40 years old. And there were satires of this, people thinking they could stop aging and dying. So I think I always thought that they would ignore the kind of medical practice you offered. They would have on the surface desire health and pick maybe one therapy and do that to specialists, but they didn't want to give up their general consumerist lifestyle. So you were on the fringe, a little more pure or stricter, or had a few odd situations like recognizing yeast, candidiasis, and that kind of stuff, and having solutions for that. A lot of people weren't into that much of the alternative knowledge landscape. So you have heard this objection about you're encouraging narcissism or people emphasizing too much their bodies and not remaining politically active or socially concerned about issues. You would start to hear that around you in the 80s, right?
Right, right. But, I mean, there's so much to describe in what she's talking about. So many layers of inconsistency, because when you don't start out by knowing that the body is missing nutrients, like the minerals and the B vitamins, then you don't have an answer for the fact that, yeah, these cells will attack other tissues because of all the yeast toxins or the deficiencies. So there are reasons for every kind of objection she makes that she doesn't recognize, because she and the rest of the society have been brainwashed by medicine to think that you're just going to get sick and die, and you need drugs, and you need a lot of tests. So she's very correct in saying that we over-screen people. I mean, that's just a big business. But then she just gives up because she thinks there's no answer.
The thinning of the bones is normal acceptance knowledge.
It's normal as you age, so leave it alone. And the reason why you have to exercise is to keep your muscles strong, which helps support your bones.
Okay, so you accept the thinning of the bones.
Yeah, but even so, when you do balance out your minerals, you don't lose bone.
Yeah, you can actually counter that inevitability. Your products can.
Yeah.
Which are special products, so anybody's listening here, we're not here to sell our products, but they are unique and having pretty good effects today.
Mm-hmm.
From your perspective, our products do so well that people, very old people, start feeling healthy and energized and actually start saying, wow, I can slow down aging.
Yes. So we, because of the results that we've seen, then everything that people are saying about, well, you just have to accept that you're going to die, so therefore eat, drink, and be merry. and people just don't take responsibility for being and staying healthier, which I think is their responsibility, even in a sense, to their family and friends and society. Because you just if you just give up, then you can't contribute anymore.
So this is what you just said, the last 2 minutes, is what she sees all over the place as a propaganda that you can do something about your aging.
Because we know you can. She's never seen that you can. She doesn't know what we're doing. But again, we're not talking about ourselves here, but what these kind of middle-class professional people, maybe women especially, have done is they've specialized in their profession, and they've allowed doctors to specialize on their bodies, which I think is very inappropriate. Medicine should not be a specialty for someone outside your own body. So they've given up their bodies and let someone take over, and then, as I've said many times, medicine has abandoned us and gone straight into drugs and surgery and not done anything to make people understand what we understand about the nutrients and yeast overgrowth and lack of minerals and B vitamins. Mm. So there.
Okay, so you said this in the 80s, what you just said now, and the 90s, and you found that acupuncture, homeopathy, and these things maybe were just palliative. They weren't always very effective. And you decided, it was like 10 years ago, people were getting sicker and sicker, even those that were on alternative medicine programs.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that happening? What were you seeing?
Because they still didn't look at magnesium. People would take magnesium, the incompletely absorbed form, the forms that would cause the laxative effect, so they could never get enough to make a difference in the body. And so that led to people looking for more and more or other cures, because they didn't, even if they thought magnesium would be a great thing to take, they couldn't take enough of it. So there was that swirling around of the magnesium deficiency problem. There was all the business about looking at genetics and thinking that all we have to do is define the human genome and then splice in good genes and remove the bad ones. That didn't pan out. And then the yeast overgrowth from all the drugs that we've been taking, medicine completely ignored that, and that means people end up with autoimmune diseases, cells attacking the body, and then she just gave up. She says, you know, who knows what would help. She just gives up.
Well, she's shocked about the macrophages. Mm-hmm. Tell us something about what you know about the macrophage. But before you do, we'll point out that you, 20 years ago, wrote a book on the magnesium miracle, or the miracle of magnesium, which has slowly become a pretty good seller. I don't know if we call it a bestseller, but it led into your magnesium research and solution for a lot of the issues that she isn't aware of.
Right.
So
it's like, you know, everybody's a dupe of medicine, but at the same time, as she points out, people are realizing that medicine isn't helping. And then medicine gives no choices other than their drugs and surgery. So it is very frustrating for
her age group.
For her age group.
And people younger. So there is this panic of people saying, well, my regular medicine is really bad, screwed me up.
Yeah.
Maybe there are solutions and I don't have to accept this. And they start experimenting, especially with the internet. They can read about all kinds of so-called solutions. And you've watched that over the last 15, 20 years, and you've had a lot to say about it. And then you found a solution, a couple of solutions, the cellular-sized, pico-sized magnesium that is tremendously effective. and studies are being done now that might support that. So let's see. So granted, your view is a minority view at this point.
Right, because if you look at the Amazon editorial reviews of these, you know, Pulitzer Prize-winning writers, you know, her sharp and fearless take on mortality, privileges, joy over juice fast, and argues that regardless of how many hours we spend in the gym, death wins out. I mean, it's so sad that they don't realize there is help, but yeah.
But you're not advocating juice diets.
No, they sort of corral their thinking into just the myth of spas and wellness. She says it's only for the rich. She's really turning off so many people to looking to keep on looking to feel better, live longer. She just what is it? Pricks their bubble.
Well, she acts wise, and wisdom in the old sense is you accept your fate and dying. You know, you don't think unrealistically about surviving death. Mm-hmm. It's natural to age and die.
Right.
Now, you found that that's not necessarily the case now.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have did you support juice diets 20 years ago?
No. I mean, I think they were extreme. I would have a case which would make me see the light at certain of these fad diets. I had a young boy who started to get migraine headaches after his mother started giving him carrot juice. And I thought, oh, yeah, high sugar, high carbs, it's affecting him. You can't be fanatical. A lot of the raw vegetarian vegan people, they went heavily into fruit and natural desserts. They just went so high into sugar and carbs and made their diet unbalanced in that way.
So you always had a moderate view of these things, were aware of all the different fads, did some of them yourself to check it out, and you always remained not so enthusiastic until you discovered the role of magnesium. And then you, quote, became a fanatic on the magnesium. You could be perceived that way.
Right.
And, yes, but and you didn't have a solution, really, other than regular magnesium or one or two products that were seen to be okay. But when you invented a product that would get into the cells and be 100% absorbed, it seems, then you had dramatic results. Dealing with something that is involved with 700 enzymes in the body, enzyme systems,
right.
Namely magnesium. So you realized that you actually could help a lot of people who were otherwise failing on the allopathic front and failing on the naturopathic front.
Yeah, right. And both of them said several times how, well, there's no research to show that any of this is working. And that's ridiculous. There are hundreds of thousands of research papers on certain diets, certain supplements, certain lifestyle, certain even attitudes. So to toss it off and just say, oh, there's no research, it's kind of just giving up.
Okay, so she used to be concerned about what she ate and be picky. Now she's just going to, was it eat, drink, and be merry? And in general, if you're wrong, that's the right attitude. But you've got so much interesting new effects happening, beneficial effects, that you wouldn't support the eat, drink, and be merry. You can get to that point with our products. They're so good that you can start eat, drinking, being merry, and even stay on your medications.
Yeah, but I don't say that. I mean, I'm not going to. That's extremist itself. But what people do is they feel so good, and then if they go out and have a binge, they don't like the feeling, so they go back to
Moderation.
Moderation, yeah.
Okay, so so she didn't like, Barbara Aaron didn't like this positive thinking kind of stuff in the working coaching world 20 years ago, whenever she wrote that book 15 years ago, about the self-development courses to make yourself a better employee or even become a millionaire kind of stuff. So now she's found the more a later trend where these people that were into positive courses 15 years ago now are really getting old and dying, and they're frantic, and she's seeing there's a panic, an unhealthy panic there. You would agree that there is a panic? Do you understand the old-fashioned wisdom she's projecting?
Yeah, there is a panic. That's where when people stumble upon us, they're taking their dozens and dozens of supplements and doing things out of fear, out of paranoia. And we just sort of gently say, no, you don't have heart disease or this, that, or the other. You just have a mineral imbalance, and why don't you try to balance things out and see how you feel?
Right. So there's also the industry, and she's correct to, as you already said, that the screen testing and these all these different kinds of tests is overdone. So you support her on that point.
Mm-hmm.
The macrophage, that is, they found out, oh, it starts invading people, and the scientists sort of proving that are not noticing why the macrophage reverses on its protective role, right?